From the Sky News Centre at 6, six police officers in the US city of Baltimore have been charged over the death of a black man injured in custody. The case of 25-year-old Freddie Gray sparked riots. Prosecutors say he was murdered and should never have been arrested. President Barack Obama has been giving his reaction.
It is absolutely vital that the truth comes out. Justice needs to be served. All the evidence needs to be presented. Those individuals who are charged obviously are also entitled to due process.
Former Falkirk MP Eric Joyce has been found guilty of assaulting two teenage boys in a North London shop. He denied the charges. The Labour leader, standing by a promise to go it alone in a bid to become Prime Minister, ruling out any cooperation with the SNP. Nicola Sturgeon's accused Ed Miliband of being in denial. The first of three British helicopters is on its way to Nepal as an appeal is made for more aircraft to help with the aftermath of the earthquake there. Charities say communities close to the epicentre are almost completely devastated. The ex-fiancé of one of America's best-paid TV stars is suing her to use the frozen embryos they created together. Tom Harrigan has more.
Sofia Vergara is known around the world for her role as Gloria from Sky One's Modern Family. But now she's attracting attention for a very different reason. Her ex, Nick Loeb, told the New York Times he wants to use their embryos to have children via a surrogate. Sophia wants them to stay frozen. Diane Blood won a legal battle to use her late husband's sperm in the 1990s.
It's a very sad case. Those embryos do feel like babies.
But experts say if Nick brought his case in the UK, he'd lose.
The law in this country requires consent of both partners.
He'd argued keeping the embryos frozen would be tantamount to killing them.
And England's cricketers are being made to toil on day one of the final test in the West Indies. A short time ago, they were 76 for three. That's the latest. I'm Claire Gregory.
L'Afrique est pleine de tristesse de voir nos familles mourir. Ne touchons pas nos malades, ne touchons pas nos mourants. Tout le monde est en danger, les jeunes et les anciens. Il faut agir pour nos familles.
BCFM is very proud to support the Every Child Deserves a Future fundraising gala dinner in support of survivors of the Ebola virus in Sierra Leone. This event includes a sumptuous meal, auction, presentations, and stunning entertainment from artists Kizzy Morell, Celestine Walcott-Gordon, Ed Chuckle, and poet Miles Chambers, to name just a few. Funds raised from the dinner will be used to provide education and counseling services for survivors of the Ebola virus and their families. Every Child Deserves a Future takes place on May 16th at Colston Hall. It starts sharp at 6 p.m. and will be followed by an after party at Plantation Caribbean Bar and Restaurant. Tickets for this very special occasion cost £50 or £100 for the VIP option. To get your tickets or to sponsor this very worthy cause, please call African Voices Forum on 07862 729 403, or email them at africanvoicesforum@yahoo.co.uk.
Welcome back to BCFM's General Election Politics Show with me, Tony Gosling. So around the table tonight, we have representatives of four of the five main parties standing here in next Thursday's general election. The Conservative Party have not put anyone forward for tonight's discussion. For Labour, standing again in Bristol East, it's a sitting MP, Kerry McCarthy. For the Liberal Democrats in Bristol South, Mark Wright. Green Party candidate in Bristol North West is Justin Quinnell. Finally, standing in Bristol South for the UK Independence Party, it's Chairman of Bristol UKIP, Steve Wood. And let's start on a question which Kerry McCarthy brought up just as we were listening to the news there, which is legal aid and legal advice. And I want to start with you, Kerry, because we've seen big changes, haven't we, in legal aid, which has had a massive effect for many people, for example, trying to claim employment rights since the 2010 election.
Yeah. I mean, one of the well, I was going to say one of the worst things that the past government's done, but there is quite a lot of competition, but introducing employment tribunal fees of £1,200 to bring it. So if you wanted to bring a case of racial discrimination, sex discrimination, unfair dismissal, you would have to try and find £1,200 up front to take the case there. And that's without things like legal fees on top of it. And that's obviously a deterrent to people bringing cases. And, yeah, it flies in the face of natural justice that people should be prevented from doing that. So we've said that we will repeal those fees. On the wider scale of things, I mean, certainly, you know, I've had lots of discussions with local lawyers about how some of the so-called reforms the government are bringing in, making it much harder for particularly the lawyers in the inner city areas to make a living, because sometimes they deal with clients that actually do require more time and attention. So if you're just giving them fixed fee contracts, for example, where they have to deal with everyone in the same space of time, it's going to be the people that deal with customers that need interpretation, for example, that struggle. So we're looking very closely at how we can sort of try to reverse some of that. And there's also a knock-on impact on things like advice services. We don't have as many of them in Bristol because local government cuts. And I'm certainly seeing more people come to my office who can't get the right legal advice.
Steve Wood for Bristol UKIP, you were talking about everyone should be equal under the law earlier on. Well, it seems that if you're poor, sometimes you simply cannot afford to hire a lawyer. You won't be able to afford to.
Yeah, that's wrong. Some of you may not know this, but I work in the legal sector, and I have to deal a lot with domestic violence issues in the sense that I get the documents to serve on the person who's committed the domestic violence.
So what do you actually do?
I have two companies. I'm a private investigator and a bailiff. And since the legal aid reforms have come in, the Legal Services Commission has cut down on people receiving legal aid in domestic violence, and they have to jump through hoops to get it. I have a personal experience of that, where we tried to get my daughter legal aid when she had a situation with domestic violence. She had to get a letter from her doctor, she had to get a letter from a social worker, and it is absolutely wrong. The people who need legal aid need to be able to turn up at a lawyer's office, get an emergency legal aid certificate, and get the help they need, especially people who are suffering domestic violence. And let's be honest, whilst the majority of domestic violence is created against women, there are a few men where it gets created against too. I think the levels are somewhere in the region about 90% against women, and those women need to be able to go to a lawyer, give evidence, and get a interim injunction order so that they can protect themselves. This business where they have to jump through hoops, where they have to get a doctor's letter, they have to see a social worker, it's almost like saying, well, I won't help you unless you come to me with a bruise. And we know that domestic violence is not just physical, it's emotional, it's control, and it needs to be stopped.
Okay, Justin Quinnell for the Green Party. There's been big changes to legal aid. It's been withdrawn in many areas. Employment law, sometimes the things like in housing cases, people simply cannot get any legal aid anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be that, the Law Centre down at Stokes Croft, which was an amazing place, and, you know, there it was accessible, and it made itself accessible. You just had to either go in, people would see you, you could phone up at certain times, and you'd be listened to. And you would be listened to. There wasn't any worry about sort of, let's say, being able to afford, and a lot of people have lost that, and I don't believe they now feel that they have any easy avenues into being able to sort of fight their corner with things. If you're part of a union and stuff like that, then you can sort of like get that back up, but if you're just an individual getting sort of like, you know, getting ripped off by some landlord or sort of, let's say, some employment sort of case or whatever it is, then it is getting incredibly difficult. I have experience of the Law Centre myself. I've known people who've worked there and things, and it was an amazing space. And that's what we need to have in a fair society. We need to be able to have law accessible to everybody.
Mark Wright for Lib Dems. There's been big changes here. Why is there any particular reason why we should have legal aid? Surely, if someone wants a lawyer, they should pay for it.
I think, well, legal aid obviously exists for much of the same reason that, you know, we have a welfare safety net, which is that not everyone has enough money to get themselves a defence in court or to help get an issue resolved that they need to. And that's why legal aid exists. And it is a good idea. Absolutely, it has to exist. Of course, it's always about balance, though, because it's also true that there was huge growth in the legal aid bill in the previous decade. I think it tripled under the Labour Party, and there was no way that it could carry on growing as it had done. And likewise, the amount of tribunals that were being launched was also growing enormously over the years. And tribunals, so for example, which in this case what you're referring to is normally about a tribunal brought by an employee who's been sacked by a company wanting to say that they've been unfairly sacked. And I know that I often speak with small business, and this is a real issue that small business have, which is that they find, you know, they don't... They find that they've got rid of a worker that they didn't think was very good, and then a few months later they're clobbered with a tribunal, and they're staring down the barrel of being hit for £40,000 of a tribunal settlement. And for a small business, actually, being clobbered for £40,000 for sacking someone who happens to have won a case saying that they were unfairly dismissed, that can absolutely destroy a small business. And they were very...
won a case, though, because that would be a judicial decision that they were unfairly dismissed. So if you say it makes it sound as though you think that it's always the employers are always right and that people don't have the right to take employees to court.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I think, the government has tried to tighten up the regulations in this area, which is fair enough. Small businesses are not always, keeping records of everything in a way which they probably ought to. And the reality is, I think the courts tend to find in favour of, in favour of the employees, quite often for, fairly spurious grounds. And I think that was something.
So, Mark, are you saying this is actually a good change for small businesses?
I think the changes on tribunals were a good change. I think the balance had moved too far in favour of the employers there.
Yeah, they have, I think, Mark, but the problem is that the people who need it the most are suffering. And I'll accept what you're saying in relation to tribunals. Yes, there were spurious allegations made, but we haven't got a happy medium. The people now who need it the most, I go on about it, the people suffering domestic violence, the people who have injuries and can't get a lawyer, these are the people that have to be looked after. We have a duty of care. If an employee feels that he has been mistreated and has been dismissed under the correct legislation, then he should be the one paying for the lawyer first. And if he wins his case, then it can be reimbursed to him under the claims. But the people who are missing out are the people at the bottom.
I'd just like to draw in a line under this and point out that we had one of the, I think he was a master of the Bristol Law Society or something, in on the programme in 2013. It was the first ever time in history where Bristol lawyers had actually gone on strike because of changes to the legal aid system, which I was quite surprised at. Anyway, on to talk about Freemasonry now, because over the last few years, this programme has exposed two prominent local politicians as Freemasons. Former Mayor of Weston-super-Mare, Philip Judd, who's now serving a 14-month jail sentence for possessing hundreds of pornographic images of films and films of children, and last Parliament's MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lopresti, both Conservatives. Should candidates, people think, declare their membership of secret societies like Freemasonry when standing for public office? Perhaps, Mark, you first.
It's an interesting topic. Should they declare it? I'm not sure, to be perfectly honest. I mean,
a business interest would be declared.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, business interests are declared, and quite thoroughly, in fact. And I think, actually, the law, I mean, even local politicians, I'm an elected councillor, and I have to declare anything that I'm involved with. And I think that's absolutely right, because we don't want people to get any impressions of impropriety or people pulling strings and getting political decisions in order to benefit themselves. I must admit, I don't really think that these old organisations like the Freemasons are really pulling strings behind the scenes anymore. I'm not really a believer in that. I've been in elected politics in Bristol for 20 years, and people say that Bristol is a hotbed of Freemasonry, this and that, and I can't say... People certainly do. Some people do. I've never seen any of it. I've never seen any of that stuff going on. I mean, there is an organisation that you guys like to talk about, the Merchant Venturers. They're not a secret society. They're actually quite public. I mean, you can find out who's in what. They're basically like a business club of mates who lobby and back each other up at the right occasions. That's a bit annoying sometimes, but they're public. Everybody knows who they are. Everybody knows that they've got the same business interests and they all own property in the same places and that kind of stuff. Like I say, it's a bit annoying, but it is public. I don't think there's anything secret about it.
Kerry, for Labour.
Well, I do think transparency is important. So I think that the more, to put information in the public domain, I suppose, as Mark says, it's in the past it's always been assumed that the only influence upon you would be if someone's paying for you to vote a certain way. I don't actually think that MPs should have outside interests or second jobs. Yeah, outside financial interests as directorships or consultancies. And Ed Miliband has said that he would ban that if Labour get elected. So I think that's one aspect. But there are lots of other ways in which people could be influenced. And I suppose what's at the bottom of it is I don't really know what Freemasons do these days and whether it is likely to be something that would influence them. If there was evidence that there was, an awful lot of shady dealing and discussions going on and strings being pulled, then I think that ought to be in the public domain. But well, I suspect that it's
one of the things that is in the public domain is that it's quite clear that there was a Freemasonic network, and maybe still is, in the Metropolitan Police between people who were sources at the News of the World were getting information from public bodies through those Masonic lodges.
Are they not banned from being Masons now, the police?
No, they're certainly not.
No. All right.
Anyway, maybe Justin on this as well. I would point out as well that around about 2005, for a couple of years, it was on the Declaration of Interest forms of all councillors and MPs for a couple of years that you had to put if you're a member of a secret society, because that's where I saw Jack Lepresti. He put a little note there saying, I'm a Freemason, but it's not a secret society, underlined twice. So for a while it was. The Standards Board of England used to look at this kind of thing, and then the Standards Board of England was abolished. But anyway, Justin, what were your thoughts about secret societies?
I've never encountered a funny handshake. It's rather a shame. Obviously, sort of like they are around and stuff. I'm not sure how massively significant they are, as you mentioned, the Merchant Ventures and stuff. One thing I did learn the other day was that, is GCHQ, and the fact that they are trying to employ loads and loads of people with autism. If you've got an autistic child, then and they're going through school, GCHQ want to know, and it's really weird that they're starting to sort of, let's say, trying to tap into people who are, let's say, not distracted by things and very good at maths and things like that. And that's something that is really odd, the fact that, let's say, Freemasons are one thing, but GCHQ is another. There are secret societies and secret organisations, but the MOD don't usually sort of seem to come under that bracket.
I mean, the problem, from my point of view, is looking at the oaths that the Masons swear, it's quite clear that their oath of loyalty is to their own organisation, some would call a religious cult, rather than to the public, which is why I question, can they actually swear these oaths and then stand for public office? Anyway, Steve Wood, what are your thoughts about the Masons? Is this something big or
not? Well, here's a newsflash. I'm a Freemason. There's my ring. I've been a Freemason for 15 years. I'm extremely proud of the fact, and Freemasonry is the biggest donator next to the National Lottery. We donate to charity. We are not a secret society, and we are not a society with secrets. You can go onto the internet and you can find out anything you want to. We have a massive amount of money given to charity. In fact, the Freemason Hall in London was the first people who put their hand in their pocket when the tsunami hit the Philippines, and we immediately sent across in excess of £5 million.
Would you be happy for a little box on your declaration of interest?
I have no problem saying I'm a Freemason. I have no problem with anybody who asks me. I'm extremely proud of the work we do with charity. We fund UK diabetes to the tune of around £2 million a year. We have massive amounts of members, some who are rich, some who are not. And we have others who give 20p, 30p a week, and some who give.
But the
thousands.
Bottom line is, should it be declared, do you think, or not?
It's up to everybody's individual
like a business interest.
Let's ask you a question. Are you a member of a golf club? And if you happen to want to declare it, would you?
Yeah, well, I'm not a member of a golf club, but I don't swear Masonic oaths to join my golf club. That is oaths of loyalty to my own organisation.
There are three main, well, four if you want, main rules in Freemasonry. The first one, you must believe in a higher being. Whether it's God, Allah, Buddha, doesn't matter, but you must believe in a higher being. The second rule is that your family come first, then your work, then Freemasonry. So whatever we do, our family and our work must come before Freemasonry. And we also swear an oath that we will not use our connections to get where we want to go. That might have been the case 100 years ago, but let me tell you, it certainly isn't the case now. And if I had to rely on Freemasonry to keep me in work, I would be bankrupt.
So do you think it should be declared or not?
It's entirely up to anybody. I don't declare
I declare my business interest, it says you must declare your business interest there.
Well, if people want to declare it, if it's on a form, they have an option. It's called a human right. You know, if people want to say they're a Mason, they have a right to say it. There are some people of old school who say that we shouldn't be saying it. I'm proud of the fact that I help people. I'm proud of the fact that I'm a Freemason. I'm proud of the fact that we're the second biggest donator next to the National Lottery to people who need it.
Any more comments on that?
And just when you say it's family, work, then Freemasonry, I still don't quite get what Freemasonry is, unless it's just about the charitable side. Is it like the Rotary Club?
Yes, it is a charitable organisation. There's a lot of symbolism involved in it, and it goes back 300 or 400 years, if not longer. But primarily, Freemasonry, for the last 200-300 years, has been a charitable organisation. We have bursaries that we give to kids who can't afford to get to university. We fund them. We help people who need hospital treatment, who can't get hospital treatment because it's going to be too long. You know, and it's not just ingrowing toenails. We will pay for heart bypasses and things like that. We pay out millions and millions of pounds every year to people who need it. And you don't have to be a Freemason to get it.
But you have a noose around your neck. Did you have that when you were initiated?
I can't tell you that because we are obliged not to say certain things.
And a knife to your chest?
I can't tell you that either.
Okay. I would actually rather heart bypasses were paid for by the NHS, I've got to say.
Yes, but the trouble is, Kerry, we know that the waiting lists are there. And if somebody can go private and that it can be done with the help of an organisation and we never ask for the money back.
Okay, on to another subject now, surveillance. Edward Snowden's shown the internet and phone networks are being used by signals intelligence agencies. We heard about GCHQ just now, and also the National Security Agency in the United States, not just to spy on politicians. We had Angela Merkel's phone being hacked, journalists and lawyers, but also for mass surveillance of us all. Many believe this strays into criminality because it bypasses due process of judges and the courts. So I'll ask first Mark Wright for the Lib Dems. Is Snowden a hero or a traitor?
He's a hero. He's one of the biggest heroes of the last decade, I think. I've mentioned I'm a scientist. I'm also a computer programmer. I've long been involved with issues about privacy and civil liberties. I've been campaigning against ID cards, for example, since about 2003. Finally, we are very pleased to have scrapped them back in 2010 when the coalition government came in. Now, it's absolutely true to say that the secret services of Britain and America and a number of other countries are completely out of control at the moment. They're completely out of control. They've been given free rein partly because of the war on terror that we touched on earlier, but also because new technologies have been coming in faster than politicians have been able to understand them and able to regulate the secret services' behaviour in them. One of the things which has disappointed me greatly is that the British courts have looked at some of these intrusion cases, some of the things that Snowden raised, and have found in favour of the government on the most ridiculous cases, I think. You know, the Guardian journalists who were, you know, holed up and arrested and detained in Heathrow Airport, clearly a massive violation of a law which I already thought was heavy-handed and which I opposed, clearly not within the law, and yet somehow the judges were looking for spurious grounds on which to protect the government on this. I think the reality is the courts are not going to do the job for us. They are not going to uphold these laws. For some reason, the judges in Britain and a number of countries have got a real blind spot when it comes to the behaviour of secret services. And so I think Snowden is needed. He was absolutely necessary to come forward and basically to leak it. Because we cannot rely on the police and the courts, I think, in this specific area of secret service behaviour. We cannot rely on them to stay within the law.
Is there any way to properly, oversee the secret services in this way? I mean, because we've got the Intelligence and Security Committee, haven't we? Malcolm had to resign as chair of that earlier this year.
I had a lot of respect over the years for Malcolm Rifkin. I thought he was one of a small number of Conservative MPs that I quite respected. But then, when he was when it was down to him and his committee to look into this, I think he was found wanting. He was really, really weak and limp on it, and that destroyed a lot of his credibility, which is a shame. I think he should have realised when he saw just how bad it was that the writing was on the wall for that particular game that they were playing, and he should have gone for them. But he wanted to. I think he wanted to stick with the establishment, and I was really disappointed.
No, you're painting
about that.
A picture of a security services out of control. How do you rein them back in?
I think probably we're going to need, like I said, because the courts are not going to enforce the laws that we have in place in the way that they were intended. So I think probably we need new laws. I know Nick Clegg and the Lib Dems have come forward. We've got some stuff in our manifesto about giving greater protections to whistleblowers and getting their fingers a little bit deeper into the secret services. I think we need. I mean, I'm disappointed there's not more support from the other two parties, because the reality is, you know, it's a bit like Trident. If the big two on these issues of national security, if they agree, then frankly, nothing much is going to change.
Steve Wood for the UK Independence Party. What are your thoughts about Snowden? Is he a traitor or is he a hero?
I think that Snowden and the Guardian are both traitors. We have MI5 and MI6 for a reason, to protect us, and sometimes things have to be protected in secret. And I personally believe if you've got nothing to hide, you haven't got a problem. We have a mass amount of CCTV in the UK at the present moment in time, and it's growing. We all have the opportunity to have CCTV outside our house. I currently drive around with a dash cam to lower my insurance. But there's a reason we have it, because there are those out there who want to hurt us, and Snowden put people's lives at risk. There are agents who are putting their life on the line every day working undercover, whether that be in the UK to gather information from terrorists, or whether it be overseas working to try and stop terrorists getting to this country.
But do you think that the security services at GCHQ, these people should be going to a court and getting a court order before they put someone on a surveillance? Because it's clear they're not doing that.
Well,
they're going for mass trawls of millions of people's data all at once.
If they want to read my emails, good luck to them. You know, that's all I'll say.
So it doesn't bother you that they're not going to a court?
It doesn't bother me. I would rather those people stand on a wall, and when I go to bed at night, they protect me. And that's why I'm proud of our armed services and our military, whether they're civilian or not. We want to be protected. We have a right to be protected. We have a burglar alarm on our house for a reason. And our security services are our burglar alarm. We will always get rogue operatives. You will always get rogue police officers. You will always get a rogue army person or navy person. They have to weed those out quickly. Personally, I'd rather they stood on that wall than me. I wouldn't want to do it, but I'm grateful they do.
Well, the US Jewish writer Edwin Black wrote a book, IBM and the Holocaust, and he was looking at the way that the Nazis used mass surveillance back in the 1930s and early 1940s, really abused it. They were using computers basically to select the people that they would...
No different than the European Union in the fact that they have got mass surveillance on us already, and it's trying to be increased.
And what about confidential client lawyer communications, for example?
Well, yes, of course, they should be held private unless it's a threat to our society.
But we found from Snowden, they're not private.
I got to be honest, I haven't seen anything that... I haven't read the emails because I'm just not interested. But the people who protect us, in my humble opinion, should be protected from people like Snowden.
OK, Justin Quinnell for the Green Party.
Yeah, well, I think that it's not as if the Secret Services don't exactly self-police well. But I'd like to go on to the sort of CCTV thing. I'm a pinhole photographer, and I put pinhole cameras around the place doing six-month exposures. And I thought I'd do one of the motorway junction where I live, and I just wandered along with a little step ladder and got my camera. And next thing you know, about three van loads of police sort of pile on top of you. You know, the CCTV cameras are there because people don't police in a community way anymore. It's basically, oh, that's happened, right, we'll see if it's a serious one, if it goes above this grade, then we'll sort of, like, you know, check what's happened from that there onwards.
But Justin, how many crimes have been detected because of CCTV?
How many people
have been stopped from committing a crime because of CCTV? Yeah,
how many also have been ignored? I mean, I think there's a level at which, let's say, you want to be able to have communities rather than just being watched the whole time.
The old days with rose-tinted glasses where you had the old lady looking out of a window and would go out and say, don't do that. People are afraid to approach people because they don't know what they're going to get.
No, I think people are not approaching people, interacting with people, because they're making their front gardens into car parks, because people are driving at far more than a 20, 30 mile an hour zone, because basically people don't interact and we don't have communities anymore. We need to start re-establishing communities and communication within them.
And we need our safety as well, and their safety. And personally, if that means that somebody sat in a room watching a CCTV camera, watching me walk down the road, well, I've got nothing to hide, and if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to worry about.
Okay, Kerry McCarthy for Labour. What's your thoughts on surveillance and the revelations of Edward Snowden? Is he a traitor? Is he a hero?
I think, obviously, we do need to keep such things under scrutiny and to make sure that they're not being abused. And one of the things, I've been Shadow Human Rights Minister in the Foreign Office team for the last few years, and I had a very interesting meeting with a group called Privacy International a while ago about how, you know, obviously we hear lots about arms exports and not selling equipment that could be used either for external aggression or internal repression to sort of regimes that have a very bad human rights record. And their concerns were that increasingly we're starting to export surveillance equipment to these countries that are then being used in very sort of ways that we certainly wouldn't find acceptable, and to spy on people and to control the people within those countries. So I think there's obviously something that we need to make sure is kept under scrutiny. I have concern with CCTV, actually. I mean, usually I find that communities in my constituency are more likely to come to me wanting CCTV than to be objecting to it. So I was at the mosque under the M32 flyover today talking to a gentleman who lives around May Park School, and they've got an ongoing issue, have for many years, with prostitution on the streets. And we have found that mobile CCTV cameras deter the curb crawlers and in some cases help the police arrest the curb crawlers. But that is an example where the community is totally on board. I, you know, slightly uncomfortable with the idea that you're being watched everywhere you go, but I think that, as Steve said, it does sometimes provide a useful purpose.
I can remember a survey from 2011 of CCTV that supposedly, anyway, proved that it didn't reduce crime at all, that there wasn't actually no reduction in crime when CCTV went into an area.
Well, I think you quite often see in court cases where, you know, where people have been assaulted, for example, you know, in murder cases, where you can actually piece together the evidence of who has travelled from one place to another at a certain time of night. So I think that's, you know, it definitely has been useful.
Now on to the Metro Bus, formerly known as Bus Rapid Transit. Construction of Bristol's £200 million Metro Bus has started. Guided buses will run from Emerson's Green and another spur from Cribbs and the new housing estates at Patchway down to Temple Meads and then down south round the Ashton Vale and Hengrove Loop. The Bristol scheme follows two other fraught UK guided bus experiments. In Cambridge, their busway suffered construction delays and has cost nearly three times what the council originally signed up for. Then Luton and Dunstable busway attracted only a third of the promised passengers. Luton Council are refusing to pay a £3 million shortfall, and a costly legal battle with construction firm Bam Nuttall is looming. The council are also having to deal with hundreds of compensation claims as residents next to the busway say jarring vibrations are making home life unbearable. Across the channel, the French city of Caen scrapped their guided buses and replaced them with trams in 2011. Bristol Mayor George Ferguson has signed it off, but will Bristol's Metro Bus experiment work? Well, Cambridge accountant Tim Phillips runs local public transport campaign Cast Iron, and he's worried that Bristol may be another costly guided bus experiment.
Was the first of what the government at the time wanted to have as demonstration projects. Now, by definition, if you want to prove that something doesn't work, then you have to let those demonstration projects go through and say after the end of the project, if you like the demonstration, it's a nice idea, but actually it hasn't worked. I have a horrible feeling that Bristol is the third guinea pig after Cambridgeshire and the Luton Dunstable guided busway, and I have a horrible feeling in the sense that the three of us have become sacrificial lambs, and I think we'll see the common sense at the end of the day, and eventually somebody will say, well, we gave it a go, but it didn't work. What we'll end up being left with, I don't know. It's a mess in Cambridgeshire. It really is an engineering mess, which is a scar on the countryside and a bad legacy. How that will work out in Bristol, I really can't say.
That's Tim Phillips there from Cambridge, their Cast Iron campaign, which is a public transport campaign in the city. He's saying it's been a bit of a disaster over there, an engineering disaster. Also, it's not attracting, in some places, as many passengers as we're being told. What are your thoughts about how this is going to develop over the next few years? Kerry McCarthy.
Well, I used to be a councillor in Luton in the mid-1990s, and we'd already been talking about TransLink, as it's called, for a very long time then. And I have to say that I was never particularly convinced that it would be used. It's partly because of demographics and so on, and the people's travel to work areas and things like that. And I only realised the other day, my grandfather lives there, and I only realised the other day that it was now up and running, but I've been told by family members in the area that, yes, it's not used and it's mostly empty. My issue with Metrobus, you'll know that I was very much opposed to its impact on East Bristol, and particularly on the Feed Bristol site and the Stapleton allotments. But when you actually, what worried me is over the course of the past 2 years, we held public meetings at Begbroke Community Centre where we got the consultants to come out and explain to us why they thought BRT was the answer to the public transport and the traffic problems in that neck of the woods. And I went from having some questions but being broadly supportive of the idea something was being done about public transport, to by the end being completely unconvinced because they just could not justify spending 200 million. Rumours are that it's going to go well over budget anyway, and particularly in terms of putting the bus-only junction loop on the Feed Bristol site, I think that's an absolute waste of money. I think the bridge itself would cost about 20 million and might knock 3 seconds off a bus journey. I don't think it's going to be used. I think when they come up with passenger figures, it looks like they've scribbled them on the back of a fag packet, and actually they haven't taken into account the fact that they're taking people off of other buses to put them on that service. So I have the thing that disappoints me the most is that when George Ferguson ran for mayor, he said that he wanted to scrap BRT. Then he got into power and said, oh, contractually I can't, but he did go to the Department for Transport and talked about the Ashton Gate end of it and got them to significant, I think it's a bit around the M shed, got them to significantly alter the route. I asked him to do the same for BRT3. He told me that he tried and they wouldn't let him change it. And then I went to the Department for Transport, sat down with the minister, and she said they'd had no requests or approaches whatsoever from the council. So I feel quite badly let down by George Ferguson on that. And I think it's because it's something that the negative impact has been felt on East Bristol, and that's not a part of the city he ventures into very often.
Well, George might say, well, that was BRT, Bus Rapid Transit. This is a new system, Metrobus.
Well, I think it's the same. Yeah, I think the problem is with these big ambitious public transport schemes. I used to work for a transport consultancy for a time, and looking at the Leeds Supertram project and doing some work for the other passenger transport authorities as well. And it's very difficult to keep them in budget. And I think what people mostly want in Bristol is they want a decent local railway line, so the Severn Beach line, as it was known, and then they want the buses to be affordable and proper routes where you can actually get from A to B without going all around the houses. And I think to just invest in the basic bus services would be a good start, rather than these rather grandiose schemes.
Okay, let's just set aside these worries from Luton and Dunstable, where people are saying that they want to move out of their homes because their homes are shaking as these things go by. Steve Wood for UK Independence Party. But, I mean, one of the main potential dangers here is as we've heard from Luton as well, is these cost overruns. Actually, the same thing in Cambridge. But anyway, what are your thoughts about whether this is going to be a good scheme for the city?
Well, I'm not an accountant or an engineer, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to give that question a miss, because even my wife does the accounts at home. I get it all wrong, so I end up not paying bills and she deals with it. I think the Metrobus scheme is going to open up South Bristol, and as you rightly mentioned, I'm standing in South Bristol. I think South Bristol has been the poor relation of this city for far too long, and I'm hoping that by opening up South Bristol, we're going to get more investment over there. We're going to create more jobs. We're going to create more small businesses who in turn will hopefully employ local people and again boost the economy. Yeah, I'm really hopeful for the South the bus link. I really am. I think there's a few issues that need dealing with. But in the main, I'm positive for it.
Well, we're all hopeful, but Justin Quinnell, do you think, is it going to work, this metro bus?
It's not going to relieve congestion to any extent. If you're going to carry on, I mean, one of the things that's a big problem is the lack of communication or lack of joined-up thinking between Bristol, South Gloucester and this sort of neighbouring areas. They're building a whole new town on Filton Airport, and they are all going to probably want to work in Bristol.
They'll be able to hop on the metro bus, won't they?
They'll be able to hop on. A few of them will. I mean, I was on the very last train, exciting stuff, in 1963, I remember it well, I think I was one, from Portishead to Bristol, and that line there is desperately needed. You know, that would sort of relieve congestion quite considerably from Portishead and stuff. The metro bus, well, you know, it's going to be probably okay, a little bit okay. I think that it's, you know, we need to look further afield. We need to look, you know, far beyond just one little track to be able to sort out our sort of the congestion, our roads, and also the sort of pollution that happens from that. You know, we are going to go the same way as Peking and everyone else. The M32 is one big solid traffic jam in the mornings when I walk past it.
But surely what you're saying is we should have this. It's going to be a great solution.
We should have lots of solutions. This as one is very small. It's £200 million and it's not really going to... I mean, one of the things also, it got the Feed Bristol thing. I went up there and I took my kids to the protesters and stuff, and we sat amongst them and things. I even gave them a few hot water bottles and stuff. I mean, it's not a big deal, but you know, it was a massively inspiring having non-violent direct action on your doorstep, and also the importance of food and food manufacture, local food growing versus, let's say, you know, building, let's say.
But what Tim Phillips from Cambridge was saying there, Mark Wright, effectively was that you are the third guinea pig in line.
I think it's true that we're not very good at infrastructure in this country, and we haven't been for over a generation. I mean, it's probably nearer two generations since we really built some decent infrastructure in this country.
It's a bit worrying that the French city has given this up in 2011 and gone over to using trams instead.
Well, I mean, it's also worth pointing out, incidentally, that, you know, just because it's not trams isn't really what the problem is. I mean, the tram scheme in Edinburgh has just gone hundreds of millions of pounds over budget, incidentally, you know, and the problems with Crossrail is billions of pounds over budget. And those are rail projects. I think it's more a problem with the fact that we are unable to do infrastructure in general. I mean, I think the Luton Cambridge problems are. I don't think they're necessarily applicable here because they're largely rural schemes that connect towns and villages, and with large amounts of guided tramway. Whereas the Bristol scheme, one of the things which has happened as a result of the budget shavings on them is that there's now hardly any guided busway actually in these bus schemes. They're largely actually just sort of super duper bus lanes, and I think there's a lot less scope to actually get those wrong, because I mean we've actually had quite good results with the previous round of bus lane improvements we've had in Bristol. But I would agree with Steve. All three of the Metrobus routes go through South Bristol, and actually that's quite a good thing for South Bristol. Transport is an absolute nightmare in South Bristol. Unlike, you know, I mean, North Bristol, East Bristol, you've got the Ring Road, you've got the motorways, you've got the A4, you've got fantastic connections to everywhere. South Bristol has got pretty much terrible connections to everywhere, and it really, really desperately needs
transport. So is Metrobus the right scheme? Is it going to work?
Well, it's the only scheme that was on offer, so whether it's the right scheme or not is irrelevant. It was literally the only scheme that was on offer. I think it will help. It's not going to, I'll be perfectly honest, it's not going to cut congestion, because Bristol is growing so fast that all it's going to do is it's going to slow the rate of growth of congestion a bit. But the city is growing so fast, the congestion is going to still be getting worse.
If I can come in on a few points. First of all, the Luton Dunstable one is definitely not in a rural area. It's one big conurbation, and there's it's not a very green place at all. I can say that, having been born there. But you did say Luton as well. And I also think that people in East Bristol would disagree with Mark that transport is good there. I think transport is bad virtually everywhere you go in the city. Well, I travel around East Bristol quite a lot, and it's not good at all. If you look at, say, the M32, for example, coming into town. And I think one of the solutions is, and this goes back to, I think, what Justin was saying about working with other neighbouring local authorities, we desperately need more park and rides, and particularly a park and ride on the M32. That's difficult to do when we're having to fight the other three local authorities who don't want it on their land.
Isn't that mostly due to the Cabot Circus? Most of the traffic, the queues that are built up on the M32 seem to be due to that being built.
It's partly down.
There weren't so much, anywhere near as many queues before it was built anyway.
I think it's partly down to that, but that doesn't negate the need for a park and ride further down there. And, you know, it's bizarre that every other big city has a passenger transport executive type structure where they can work together and perhaps put aside the daily party politics and that to improve transport, and that Bristol doesn't have one in the West of England Partnership. So I think that's important.
It works here because, you know, all of us, we've mentioned one word, congestion. And it's interesting to note that the Mayor of Liverpool actually did away with the bus lanes, and he improved the flow of traffic by nearly 25%.
But not of buses, obviously. Anyway, on to another subject that you're not going to get much on the mainstream press, because there's not been a lot of discussion about this big subject on the mainstream media, and it's child sexual abuse. We heard in March this year that a watchdog is to investigate the Metropolitan Police over cover-up claims, and I just want to run through one or two of those claims. Allegations that documents have found at an address of a paedophile that originated from the Houses of Parliament, listing a number of highly prominent individuals, MPs and senior police officers, as being involved in a paedophile ring, and no further action was taken. An allegation that an account provided by an abuse victim had been altered to omit the name of a senior politician. Allegation that an investigation into a paedophile ring in which a number of people were convicted did not take action in relation to other more prominent individuals. Again, an allegation that a surveillance operation of a child abuse ring was shut down due to high-profile people being involved. And finally, an allegation that police officers sexually abused a boy and carried out surveillance on him. Justin Quinnell, what are your thoughts about what's happened over the last year since we heard two inquiries were set up last summer? Very little seems to have happened. In fact, some might say it's been kicked into the long grass to make sure it wasn't playing a part in this general election campaign.
Yeah, very true. Sorry, I've forgotten the guy's name who died recently.
Leon Britton.
Leon Britton. Now, my mum, who isn't around anymore, she basically told me about Leon Britton. So people knew about him. And, like, my mum's, you know, she's Lib Dem or whatever, but, like, you know, there are certain, you know, people knew things like that were happening and are happening. And, you know, it's been hideous, whether it be through, and you can pick any organisation, and it's been covered up.
Well, to be fair, Norman Tebbit, in fact, last summer, also said something along similar lines. He said, back in those days, we just used to cover these things up.
Yeah. Yes. And I think that has been the case. And, like, you can look in loads of organisations, and I'm not going to start picking them and things like that, but, like, it was something that was, like, you know, just swept under the carpet. It's hideous.
So does the Green Party have a policy to deal with this?
I don't know. It's something I haven't sort of, like, gemmed up on. One thing I have got is, like, you know, I've got bits and pieces to do with domestic violence and women and stuff like that. But the, you know, the child abuse sides of stuff, I don't know. I think that, like, it's something that, like, thank heavens people are looking into it as much as they, you know, to the extent they can, but they must look into it far more. And I think the cover-ups are happening. They are happening. And we mentioned Freemasonry earlier, and I don't want to drag that into it, but let's say being secret societies of some sorts, or secret groups of organisations, you know, groups of people keeping things quiet. And I'm not mentioning that, let's say, directly with the Freemasons, but just a group of people.
Not in Freemasonry.
No, I'm not saying it would, but let's say, you know, the church, or let's say whatever organizations you want to look at who have, let's say, had sort of, you know, things accused from them in the past and stuff like that, you know, people will keep it quiet, the police or whatever.
Steve, you say it wouldn't happen, but I mean, it's happened in Buckingham Palace.
It's happened
in many places.
What
are your thoughts about this? Because it seems to be, we're coming back to another thing we mentioned earlier, which is this business of too big to jail.
Yeah.
And I wonder what your thoughts as UKIP are about what should be done about this.
And I go back to, if you do the crime, you must be prepared to do the time. Let's go to Jenna at the moment. The CPS have turned around and said he's too ill to prosecute. Now,
you're talking about Greville Jenner,
the
Labour peer, I believe.
Yeah, now I am going to mention two Labour people, Kerry, and it's not person, it's the only two I can recall at the moment. But two Labour Party people have recently been charged, and they weren't going to get charged because they were suffering for dementia. Now, I'm not a doctor, so I can't clarify anything. However, one lady made a miraculous recovery after she was not going to be charged for expenses fraud. I'm not saying that's the case with Jenna, but I am saying that I don't care who you are. If you do the crime, I don't care how high you are, you do the time. Now, we have to get a way to open up those files. The Savile case, Buckingham Palace, politicians, policemen, I don't care who you are. And child abuse the most. It's the most foul crime one can ever think of. I don't know if our panel here have got children. I have children and I have grandchildren. And I will do time if anybody hurt them.
What about this allegation that's come along with a lot of this, that this was being used for political blackmail?
There's a possibility it could be. I'm not saying anything. I mean, we're going back in places 50, 60 years when it was a completely different world. I'm not justifying that. I'm just saying it was a different world. I've often asked this question. In today's society, we hear so much about child abuse. We hear so much about what's going on. Was it the same 60, 70 years ago, but we didn't have the open media sources and it was just brushed under the carpet?
Mark Wright, a lot of this started the latest sort of spate of this, because it was going in the 1980s and in the 1990s with the Jimmy Savile case. And actually, the reporter for the BBC that was part of that, Liz McKean, she was told by her editor at Newsnight at the BBC, she was told, well, I'm sorry, we've got a Jimmy Savile special coming up at Christmas. I'm afraid we won't be airing your piece. So, you know, there is obviously some kind of pressure to keep this out of the public domain. What would the Lib Dems do? What's your policy towards dealing with this problem?
I mean, obviously, this has been very shocking, I think, to almost everyone. There is a wide-ranging public inquiry now that's been set up and is going to look at a lot of these things. I mean, it's been delayed quite a long time, unfortunately, because they couldn't agree on who was going to chair it.
It's the third person.
Well, they finally found somebody that might do it. I mean, that's a shame. But I think, you know, part of the problem was that they were saying that the previous chairs had connections which might prejudice the way they were thinking. And if what we're talking about is cracking open, you know, the secrecy, then maybe it was right that they kept on trying again until they found someone who they were really convinced had absolutely no links to any of them, whether it's by friendships or business or whatever.
Why was somebody appointed to originally, you know, who's connected to Leon Britton?
Indeed.
It has to be somebody from politics that is on a panel looking at this. Why don't we bring in a detective, a high-ranking, profile detective?
Yeah, indeed. The person they finally settled on.
But the judge doesn't have an investigative mind, Kerry. A policeman, a high-ranking policeman, or a very senior detective will be able to take this to pieces.
Okay, Kerry McCarthy.
Well, it's not a police investigation at the moment. It's a public inquiry, and they're usually, you know, the call from the victims was for a judge-led inquiry. One of the things, I was in Parliament sort of challenging Theresa May on the composition of the inquiry and trying to push her to bring it forward, and victims were certainly getting in touch with all MPs. But I think what's important is that they are represented and their voices are heard, and Yvette Cooper very much took that up in challenging the appointment of the two previous chairs because they didn't have the confidence of the victims, and surely the confidence of the victims...
I mean, there's a very strong sense...
The last thing we want is a whitewash and another cover-up.
Can I just say, there's a very strong sense from the survivors that this has been kicked into the long grass, that it's not being dealt with where it should be being dealt with.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is one of the issues that we sort of felt, you know, with some of the discussions about the documents that couldn't be revealed, and Tom Watson has done a lot of work on this. John Mann, another Labour MP, has been doing a lot of work on this, Simon Danchuk as well, trying to get them to reveal everything as quickly as possible so that we could, not necessarily in the public domain, but reveal that information to the inquiry so we know that, you know, what was said and why weren't prosecutions brought. So it's frustrating. What we don't want, I mean, if you look at other inquiries, you know, the Bloody Sunday inquiry went on for decades.
Well,
the
there were several of them,
that Hillsborough took 20 years to find justice and still going on.
So what's your prediction for how long this is going to take to get to the bottom of it?
Well, I mean, and this is one of the frustrations of the victims is, as we know, quite a few of the perpetrators are quite elderly. We've read Liam Britton, an alleged perpetrator, has already died. Greville Janner is said to have advanced dementia. Who's another alleged victim. Cyril Smith died. And they want the people brought to justice, which means criminal justice. But you don't want to rush the inquiry. And one of the things we were asking Theresa May was, could criminal cases be brought before the inquiry concludes? You don't want it to get so bogged down in looking at every single aspect of it that no one's prosecuted. So hopefully, it is difficult, though, because you don't want to prejudice the inquiry by having prosecutions going on. But I think it is important from the victim's point of view that if perpetrators are identified, that those files are put in front of the police as soon as possible, so at least some people are held to justice.
Are we giving the victims the support they need as well?
Well, that was something else that has been asked on many occasions, because even talking about their experiences now is obviously new trauma for them. And yeah, I think it's important that they...
It is a massive amount of admiration when you get the victims coming on and actually sort of like, you know, standing up and saying, right, you know, this is me, this is how I am now and stuff. And, like, you know, I just full admiration, because it is something that, like, relies upon people's fear to keep it quiet.
And I think David Cameron was very, I can't remember the phrase, but he was very dismissive of them. He almost, well, I don't want to misquote him.
He was actually using conspiracy theories, actually. He used that expression to describe some of them. But, I mean, this isn't the only case like this. We had a Dutroux scandal in Belgium to do with some Belgian politicians connected with that. We've also had the Franklin scandal in the United States as well. So I wonder if...
the children's issue there.
It was connected with Savile too.
There's also gang grooming and sexual abuse going on in a lot of our provincial towns and cities as well. I mean, this and that's going on in this day and age. I mean, a lot of these political things appear to have happened in the 80s and 90s and a long time before. But there is still, you know, widespread abuse of children going on in the country, unfortunately.
I'd just like to draw a line under that and go round very quickly and ask you all about our final subject, which is housing and evictions. Everybody's talking about building social housing, but nobody's doing it. I'm going to give you half a minute each on what to do about it, bearing in mind that evictions have nearly doubled since 2010. So, Steve Wood for UKIP.
Evictions have actually doubled, partly because of the bedroom tax. It's people who have to pay that now or not pay it. They're in a no-win situation. They don't want to move. They want to remain in their homes that they may have been there 30, 40 years, but they're being penalised. And because they're being penalised, they're getting into arrears with their rent. And the councils are taking them to court, and they're getting eviction notices. And then they're coming along to the council and they're saying, well, I'm homeless. And the councillor is saying, well, you made yourself homeless, so it has to stop. We have to get rid of the bedroom tax.
OK, Justin Quinnell for the Green Party.
Yeah, cap rent. I remember Fair Rent Acts and stuff, where actually sort of like it was limited. I think there's a massive problem where people are treating what should be a human right, as in somewhere to live, as an asset, as something to make money from. And once you have that sort of embedded in the whole economy of the country, you're not going to get out of it. It's a hideous thing. And like building loads of homes, fine, yeah, we need to. But also we need to build, you know, homes which are sort of like sustainable in some way. There's a thing today about... basically putting solar panels and the rest on.
Okay, Mark Wright for the Liberal Democrats. Everyone's talking about building social housing.
There's actually quite a reasonable amount of housing being built at the moment, but almost none of it is social housing. And the reason for that is because the law was changed in 2011 to make it easier for the developers to get out of their social housing requirements. That was done at the time to try and make it easier to build houses to stimulate the economy. Maybe it was a good idea at the time. It's no longer necessary. That law needs to be changed to make it impossible for developers to get out of their social housing requirements.
Okay, Kerry McCarthy for Labour, finally.
Yeah, well, Labour has put a big emphasis on housing in its manifesto, and affordable housing too, and it's talked about changing the financing of council housing. But one thing we said, 11 million people live in private sector accommodation, and that is very insecure. We've said that we want starter tenancies of 3 years and a cap on rent rises above inflation during that period to at least give those people who have to live in a private sector rented accommodation some stability.
Okay, that was Kerry McCarthy. Thanks very much to our guests. Labour's Kerry McCarthy, you just heard there, Lib Dems' Mark Wright, Green Party's Justin Quinnell, and Chairman of Bristol UKIP, Steve Wood. Conservative Party have not put anyone forward for tonight's discussion. Alongside Conservative, Labour, Lib Dem, Green and UKIP, Bristol has the former merchant venturer Mayor George Ferguson, who's up for election next year, as well as several independents for Bristol candidates in next week's ballot, as well as Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, Left Unity, English Democrats, British National Party and Vapors in Power. Some are standing in the BCFM area, but outside the Bristol City boundary. Next Thursday, on election night, BCFM will be running an election special through the night. Our sister show Dialects on Mondays at 11 a.m. This week, the full interview with Cambridge Public Transport campaign Cast Iron, and also hear what their experience has been of the bus rapid transit system, and a woman who spent £30,000 on IVF treatment, then conceived naturally just by chilling out. You can listen again or download what you've just heard at thisweekoneword.co.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. See you next week, where Martin Summers will be back to pore over the election results. Until then.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, President Obama said it's absolutely vital the truth comes out about the death of a black man who died from injuries sustained in police custody in Baltimore. Prosecutors have announced 6 police officers will face charges in connection with Freddie Gray's death. Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings says he wants this case to be an example to the rest of America.
I think a message has been sent by our state's attorney that she treasures every life,
yes.
That she values...